Hi, and welcome to Shannon's Corner. I am Shannon Devereaux Sanford, and I thank you so much for joining us here today on your favorite radio station, WTBQ. And don't forget, we are now 93.5 FM, as well as our very faithful 1110 AM. And I hope you are doing great today. I hope your life is just the way you want it to be. And I hope it stays that way. But for most of us, it's never that way. Well, it can be that way at times, but it never stays that way. I think life is full of many lessons. And sometimes those lessons are very not welcome. And we don't want to go through them. We don't want to learn from them. But there they are nonetheless. So, the best we can do often in life is learn from other people's lessons and figure out our own. Obviously, it's different for everyone, but there are certain things that, mental health, for example, which is what we're going to talk about today, certain things that we should go out there and ask for help about. We can't do anything and change anything if there's a problem and we don't recognize it or ask others for help. Easier said than done on certain things. Sometimes we don't know we need it. Sometimes we're just a little too proud to ask for it. But my guest today, Stephanie Schroeder, has written a book who she's not too proud to ask for a lot of help and talk about her problems, which are going to help your problems, which is why I know she wrote this book, A Beautiful Wreck, Sex, Lies, and Suicide. And I want to welcome Stephanie Schroeder to Shannon's Corner. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you, Shannon, for having me here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, this is really an autobiography of your life and how difficult it's been in some ways, how you have overcome a lot of trials and tribulation, mental health problems, physical problems. You are openly gay. Queer feminist writer is what you call yourself.
Yes.
Now, that's an interesting statement right there. Before I go any further, how come queer? Because queer is usually a word that if I called someone queer, I would feel I might be insulting them. Is this not an insult?
It's kind of a reclaiming of what would be an insult. Formerly, but in today's gay community, it's a kind of LGBTQ is the queer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reclaiming of a word that, yes, has been an insult and an epithet in the past.
But not so much anymore.
And especially within the community itself.
Right, like you can call yourself that, but being careful. But it certainly defines who you are, and you are very openly gay. And I know in your book you say you've always been very openly gay, and you've always known you're gay, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there is
no ambiguity.
There's no ambiguity, and I think for most people, there's no ambiguity. You are what you are. I don't think that this is something, in fact, I'm sure this is something we don't choose. I think we just are who we are. We have brown hair, we're 5 feet two or 6 feet two. We are who we are. You're gay or you're straight. But you're a mental health advocate, and because you've been there, you've been through bipolar. Why are you, tell us about your mental health issues and why you are such an advocate.
Well, when I was 11, I started getting symptoms of Tourette's syndrome, which is not a mental illness. It's a neurological illness. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was the worst thing that ever happened in my life. And I wasn't diagnosed until I was 28 years old. Mm-hmm. And then I started having some other symptoms of depression and kind of just being a little bit out of it. And then I had some suicide attempts. And I was also, as you kind of alluded to, was in an abusive relationship. Psychologically, emotionally, and physically. And I attempted suicide for the first time because I felt like I had no options. And I was hospitalized and then released. I got into another relationship that was also unsatisfactory, attempted suicide a second time, and was finally diagnosed after a series of other things as bipolar at age 37. Now, this is kind of late in the game for people who mm-hmm. are mentally ill to get to be diagnosed, but I was so glad I was, because it put a name on what I was feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no, there's certainly nothing like knowing there's something wrong and then hearing it. So at least once you know it, you can claim it and then change it. It's very hard to change something you don't know.
Because I didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. And once I did have a name for it, and also knew there were treatments in the plural, and there were many different treatments, I knew I could do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And did you do something about it?
I did. I was referred to a psychiatrist from my therapist, and I got on medication, and I've been through a lot of different medications, and I'm on four different medications that help me, and I also go to psychotherapy regularly. And now I know a lot of medications don't agree with a lot of people.
Right.
I know a lot of people don't agree even about taking medication. You know, there are a lot of side effects. There are a lot of objections for a lot of different reasons. But for me, this is what works. Taking four medications, an antipsychotic, an antidepressant, an anti-anxiety medication, and a mood stabilizer, mm-hmm. and going regularly to talk therapy.
Right, which is a big help. Let me ask you, you mentioned suicide. Now, you said you've had three suicide attempts.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, and I've done shows on this with doctors. There is much research saying that some of these drugs will trigger suicide attempts. Do you think that there's any correlation?
I don't think in my case. I know that I from what I've read, almost every drug that treats something also
right.
incites that same thing. Drugs in my case did not incite my suicide, but feeling helpless, feeling hopeless, feeling I had no options, that's what prompted it. And also, ending the pain. I think people don't really want to die when they attempt suicide or even carry out a suicide. They want to end the psychic pain.
Yeah, that's true.
And don't know otherwise how to.
Right. Yes, and you know, let's be honest, for everyone who has attempted suicide, it's a cry for help because there's nothing else you can do. There's no other way out. And maybe you'll get the help you need, and maybe the help's on the other side, but that I don't think that's always, and I think you're right, that's not always where we're going. It's just that the pain is so terrible. So anybody who does this is certainly looking for some sort of help. Is there help out there?
There is help, and you talked about it in the beginning of this show. You have to ask for it. Most people, you know, I mean, if you're a child, if you're somebody who doesn't have access to health care, it's kind of hard to ask.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who want to help. There are therapists, there are parents. If your parents aren't helping, ask someone in school, ask a trusted friend, ask a grandparent or a foster parent or anybody whom you trust to confide in, that you're, you know, something might be. And I don't even want to say the word wrong. It has such a, you know, pejorative implication, but that you're not feeling right. That you think something might be up with you, and you'd like to find out what it is.
Is there a particular a theme that runs through the gay community that has a lot of mental health, or is that just, I mean, I've heard that. I don't know whether that's true. I don't know enough about it to know whether that's true. That, and, you know, a lot of people would draw the correlation that coming out, feeling that you might be a little different growing up, maybe makes you feel like you don't fit in, so therefore you acquire some sort of uncomfortable feelings that make you feel not the same, and therefore, you know, people confuse that maybe with total mental health. But is there something in the gay community that you think has more mental health than other communities?
I think there may or may not be. I haven't seen any numbers that prove that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of mental health issues in the gay community because society is not accepting, because there's bullying, because parents disown their children and they have nowhere, you know, they end up homeless, or they end up on the piers in New York City, they end up on the street, they end up in foster care, which is abusive to them, and not all foster care, but a lot.
Right, that's true.
And they end up in homeless shelters and not getting any kind of care they need, and it leads to more health care and mental health care problems than maybe the general population.
Well, you hit on a very good point here. I recently wrote an article that why gay marriage is good for our society. And I do believe it is good for our society, because I think when you push people on the outskirts of society, they don't become members. If you're married and you become a member of society and you buy a home, you have to care about the schools. If you want to raise children, you care about the community, you care about the church. I mean, you become part of society. Therefore, you have a stake in society, and you're not pushed on the outskirts. And I think when we do that to people in any form, it makes for mental health, because we feel like outsiders. So it's not productive for society, I think, for people not to accept gay marriage and accept everyone for being who they are, as long as they're not hurtful to others. You know, obviously, that's not what we're talking about here. So I think that that's a very important point. Did you find this out living, you know, on the streets, having the Tourette syndrome, having your suicide attempts, and having an up and down life? Have you found that you were less accepted?
As far as the gay issue, my parents have always accepted me as a lesbian. Mm-hmm. That's never been an issue. I think the mental health issue is actually much more of an issue and problem with both my family and other people I've encountered. Coming out as bipolar has been way more difficult as coming out as gay. So I haven't been on the streets. I have an intact biological family. Okay. I'm middle class white and, you know, have a certain amount of privilege. So it's been easier for me, as hard as it's been, to access health care, to access other services than a lot of other people might have access to.
I understand. Now, that's a really good point. If you don't have that access, if you're not middle class and you know, available for all that stuff, you can feel definitely on the fringe. Now, you say in the book that your mother had mental health issues as well.
Mm-hmm. She has been depressed most of my life.
Do you think that... runs through you because of her? Do you think you have inherited something from her? Do you think it's maybe learned behavior or just a coincidence?
I think it's all of those things. And my mother was not the only one in my life who has had mental health issues. She's had depression, or she struggled with depression. My father's mother was actually diagnosed with depression and struggled with her whole life and actually was being treated back in the day. And two of my uncles had suicides, successful, if that's the word for it, successful suicides. And I believe there was mental health issues behind both of those suicides. So I think it runs through the family kind of DNA in both hereditary. I don't know if it's learned. I don't know that depression can be learned behavior, although my mother's depression did affect me in various ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it can be a little bit learned behavior, as you say, just because it affects you. It's not that you're necessarily following her, but, you know, when we grow up, whatever goes on affects us. It doesn't necessarily, I don't think, you know, define who we are.
Right.
But it certainly is something that is there. And, you know, if we push it under the proverbial carpet, then we're never going to look at it. Sometimes we need to look it out, take it out, and realize that it doesn't really belong to you, that it might belong to her, but not you. But sometimes we wear those things unintentionally, for sure. So why did you write this book, and who did you write it for?
I wrote it partially for myself, mm-hmm. as a catharsis, and it's not a self-help book, but I do hope it helps people either realize their own situation and ask for help, realize somebody who they love situation and get them help, or help them get help. And it's also, I think, a pretty interesting story, just a good read. I've had a lot of reader responses who have indicated they connect with me through an email or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and they said, this has helped me look at my own relationships, like my abusive relationships or my own mental health. I had someone who was a nurse who read my book and gave it to a patient of hers who was in an abusive relationship but needed medication, and his boyfriend was saying, oh, you don't need that, because he wanted to remain in control. And she said, I gave him your book, and he said, oh my God, I saw myself so much in that book, and now I want to get help.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
And that makes it all worthwhile.
It certainly does. Tell us about your abusive relationships. You say ships more than one, right?
On various levels, I would say one was pure intimate partner violence, in the traditional pattern of domestic violence, with a woman that was, you know, first very subtle psychological control, emotional control, and then a little bit of physical abuse at the end. And my other relationships were manipulative or coercive, not on the same level, but yes, I was in a pattern of getting involved with people who were certainly unhealthy for me and had themselves had their own problems.
And do you, now that you look back on that and you've written the book, which is obviously a big help, it's cathartic in many ways, writing it down, looking at it, do you blame them, or do you take some responsibility as well?
Both. Mm-hmm. I think there's no reason for anyone to abuse anyone, but I also realize my own culpability in staying in the relationship, in not recognizing my patterns, in getting involved with people who clearly had their own issues going on that were pushing my buttons and I was pushing theirs. And, you know, look, I mentioned talk therapy, which has helped me immensely in getting past all of that and getting into a healthy relationship.
Yeah. So you really advocate, which I do as well. I think it's always good to talk, whether you do it with a therapist, a friend. Writing can be good. I think, you know, getting the stuff out of us to take a look at it so we don't own it so much is always very helpful. And that's really probably one of the good messages of your book, that to get it out there, to talk, to put it out there so that you don't own it and it doesn't own you, right?
But you can let it go after a while. You know, when you talk about it, you know, the whole, when you say it, it sets you free kind of thing. And talk therapy or talking to a friend or talking to anyone you trust certainly cannot hurt.
Mm-hmm. No, it can never hurt. Well, I wish you really good luck with your book. Where can everyone get a copy?
It's on Amazon.
Okay.
It's on BarnesandNoble.com. And if you want to find out more information about it, you can go to BeautifulWreck.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, terrific. Thank you so much, Stephanie Schroeder. The book, again, is Beautiful Wreck, Sex, Lies, and Suicide. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story with everyone.
Great. Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you so much. Again, everybody, the book is Beautiful Wreck, Sex, Lies, and Suicide. Go to Amazon and get a copy, because maybe it'll change your life or someone else.